is not going to necessarily be so easy for me. So there may be a political calculation here that's made looking at the electoral map. I can't really tell you. What I can tell you is that this is what Republicans wanted. They didn't do it. And now Biden is doing it and making the point, by the way, that he is not going to be demonizing immigrants.
I believe that immigration has always been the lifeblood of America. We're constantly renewed by an infusion of people and new talent. The Statue of Liberty is not some relic of American history. It stands for who we are as the United States. So I will never demonize immigrants. I'll never refer to immigrants as poisoning the blood of a country. And further, I'll never separate children from their families at the border.
Speaking of poisoning the blood of our country, in an interview responding to this statement, Trump melted down and said exactly that. We'll get to that in a moment. So is this a politically astute calculation from President Joe Biden, or is it a mistake? Well, when it comes to the states that are in question, it certainly seems to, again, cross off another item from the list of why someone might vote for Donald Trump, because now Biden did the thing. Let's talk about how Trump reacted. After President Joe Biden went right around Republicans and signed an executive order to do exactly what Trump says he would do, stop the crossing at the border, make the asylum claims be made in Mexico or source countries rather than in the United States. After Biden did this, Donald Trump gave an interview to Newsmax and completely and totally suffered a meltdown. Trump doesn't know what to do. He's furious. He's angry. He says that what Biden is doing is a hit job. I don't even know what that means. It's an executive order. How is it a hit job? Well, I'll explain that. Here is Greg Kelly with a total brown nosing softball interview of Trump.
Ago or just left in place your executive orders. What do you think of what he did today?
Well, first of all, it's a nothing what that he did, and allowing massive numbers of people still to come in. And it's just misinformation, disinformation, and just another hit job.
It is a hit job, disinformation, misinformation. Trump's furious. OK, Biden did what Trump said he would do. Biden did what Republicans were about to do until Trump said, no, pretty please don't do it. Let me do it when I'm the president so I can get credit. And now Biden did the thing. And the reason Trump hates this is he wants a problem to solve. He wants to have the issue that will linger so he can say, vote for me and I will fix it, because Biden won't. Only I can fix it. To the extent that you consider this a fix, I don't really, but to the extent that you consider this a fix, Biden did it. And so now what Trump is relegated to saying is it's a hit job in the sense that it's an attack on me. And it's not really going to solve the problem. OK, Biden did the thing I said I was going to do, but Biden did it in a way that won't really solve the problem. It's all he has left. It's all he has left. Here is Trump refreshing the line that migrants are poisoning the country, which is old school xenophobic language.
It's a terrible, terrible thing that's happened to our country. And they're coming in from prisons and jails. They're coming in from mental institutions and the step above that, insane asylums. And you have a lot of terrorists coming into our country. And it's a terrible thing that he's doing. He's poisoning our country.
So there you go. By letting people in, Biden is poisoning the country. Old xenophobic language used against so many different groups, migrants from different countries, whatever is fashionable at the time. Sometimes it's the Jews that are poisoning. Sometimes it's migrants from the Middle East, or maybe it's from Mexico, or maybe it's further south in Latin America. Trump also rehabilitated.
They're not like they lived up. I used to check it every week. Are they buying? Are they buying?
I don't even know where that came from. That was very weird. Trump also reminding us he may imprison his political opponents if he becomes president.
But wouldn't it be terrible to throw the president's wife and the former secretary of state? Think of it, the former secretary of state, but the president's wife into jail. Wouldn't that be a terrible thing? But they want.
What on earth is this guy talking about?
Do it. So, you know, it's a terrible, terrible path that they're leading us to. And it's very possible that it's going to have to happen to them.
It's possible I will have to imprison them if I become president. That's the point Trump is making. Trump just steamrolled Greg Kelly during this interview. Greg Kelly trying to wrap the interview and just not able to because Trump won't shut up.
$100 million.
It's wild.
With nothing.
Mr. President,
he's the one that's the fraud.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
They were firing at us with mortar rockets at the living room. All my relatives were wounded. There was also a lot of gunfire, F-16, quadcopters, drones. It was horrible. Soldiers in this area were all firing.
In one of the single bloodiest Israeli assaults on Gaza over the past 8 months, at least 270 Palestinians were killed, including more than 60 children, nearly 700 Palestinians wounded in that Israeli attack Saturday, the Nusayrat refugee camp that freed four Israeli hostages. President Biden responds.
But before I begin my remarks, I want to echo President Macron's comments welcoming the safe rescue of four hostages that were returned to their families in Israel. We won't stop working until all the hostages come home and a ceasefire is reached. That is essential to happen.
We'll go to Gaza for a report. Then we'll speak with two Israelis. One near Tel Aviv lost his parents in the October 7th Hamas attack. He says Israel's war is not the answer. The other, here in New York, is the head of Idealist.org. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials in Gaza say Israeli forces killed 274 Palestinians, including at least 64 children, in the Nusayrat refugee camp during an Israeli military daytime raid on Saturday to free four Israelis who'd been held hostage in Gaza since October 7th. The hostages had been held in two apartments in Nusayrat, one of the largest refugee camps in Gaza. For 2 hours, Israeli forces attacked the area by air, land, and sea. One Israeli soldier died in the raid. Hamas is claiming three other hostages were also killed. Over 700 Palestinians were injured inside the refugee camp. A survivor described the massacre.
We were in Nusayrat camp. Special forces arrived from an Apache helicopter, and there was a white car with special forces. The Apache started to bomb and fire directly at people. There was a large number of martyrs and injured people. People fled. There is a big number of displaced people. Schools and hospitals are filled with displaced people. There is a large number of martyrs, and firing was direct. We brought 10 injured people in one ambulance. One of them was shot directly. We barely made it out through the alleyways.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has called for an emergency UN Security Council session to discuss what he called a bloody massacre, as the overall Palestinian death toll in Gaza has topped 37,000. The United States reportedly provided intelligence to Israel to aid the hostage rescue effort, including drone imagery collected over Gaza. For months, the U.S. has been flying MQ-9 Reaper drones over Gaza. Israel evacuated the hostages from a beach near where the U.S. built a temporary pier to bring humanitarian aid to Gaza. The U.S. has denied the pier was used during the Israeli military operation. Israel's also denying claims it used a humanitarian aid truck to infiltrate the refugee camp. The Israeli military said the four hostages, Noah Argamani, Ahmad Meir Jan, Andrei Kozlov, and Shlomi Ziv, were all in good medical condition. This all comes as Israel is facing increasing pressure to agree to a ceasefire and hostage deal. On Saturday night, hours after the hostages were freed, thousands of Israeli protesters took to the streets. In Tel Aviv, police fired water cannons and made at least 33 arrests. On Sunday, Israeli war cabinet member Benny Gantz resigned from Benjamin Netanyahu's government and called for new elections.
Regrettably, Netanyahu is preventing us from advancing toward true victory, which is the justification for the ongoing and painful cost of war. That is why we are leaving the emergency government today with a heavy heart, but with full confidence.
Shortly after Benny Gantz resigned, Israel's far-right national security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir demanded a spot in the war cabinet. This comes as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's back in the Middle East for meetings in Egypt, Israel, Jordan and Qatar to push for the ceasefire and hostage deal outlined by President Biden. The United Nations has added Israel to its so-called list of shame, a blacklist of nations and groups that violate the rights of children in armed conflicts. Other nations on the UN list include Russia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Somalia, Syria, Burma, Afghanistan, and Haiti. The UN's also adding the Palestinian groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad to the list of shame. In Washington, D.C., tens of thousands of protesters formed a symbolic red line around the White House Saturday to protest the Biden administration's Gaza policy. A major pro-Palestinian rally was also held in London Saturday. Meanwhile, in Canada, police fired tear gas and pepper spray Friday to disperse protesters at McGill University in Montreal, where students had taken over an administrative building. 15 arrests were made. In Spain, hundreds of protesters lay down on the ground outside the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao to symbolize the mass casualties in Gaza. In France, President Emmanuel Macron Sunday called a snap election for June 30th following major losses in European Union elections to the far-right National Rally Party.
After having proceeded with the consultations as provided in Article 12 of our Constitution, I decided to give back to you the choice for the future of our Parliament with a vote. And so I am dissolving tonight our National Assembly.
Marine Le Pen's far-right RN party won over 30% of the vote in preliminary tallies, more than twice as many votes as Macron. The RN announced 28-year-old Jordan Bardella as its candidate for prime minister. The far-right made gains elsewhere, including in Italy, Austria and Germany, where the extreme-right Alternative for Germany gained 6 seats and placed second behind Chancellor Olaf Scholz's Social Democrats. Despite the boost for hard-right groups, centrist parties will still hold an outright majority in the 720-seat European Parliament. Nationalist anti-immigrant groups are expected to control 130 seats. On Saturday, an estimated 15,000 protesters took to the streets of Berlin to call out the rising power of the far right in Germany. Meanwhile, in Brussels, a group of scientists and climate activists on Friday blocked the entrance to the EU Commission.
We blocked the entrance to the European Commission because we are trying to push for degrowth. No political party really has degrowth on its agenda. And degrowth is a necessity if we want to survive this century, if we don't want to face ecological, civilizational collapse. And so we really need to talk about it.
Doctors Without Borders recovered the bodies of 12 asylum seekers off the coast of Libya in the Mediterranean Sea and transported another 165 survivors of a shipwreck to Italy Friday. Rescue workers warn the victory of the far right in EU elections will lead to more migrant deaths. Following the rescue mission, MSF blasted the, quote, devastating and bloody European policies on migration and non-assistance for people taking the Mediterranean, unquote. This is the head of the Red Cross in Spain's Canary Islands describing the treacherous journey undertaken by thousands each month.
It's a journey that, depending on where it starts, means up to 10 days at sea, where anything can happen, such as the ship sinking, tough weather conditions, storms. It's a route that has already taken on many lives, some of which we know about, and many others we don't, because they have disappeared.
In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, fighters with the Allied Democratic Forces, a group associated with the Islamic State, killed at least 41 people in an overnight attack Friday in a school in a village near the border with Uganda. The majority of victims were students. The ADF is also accused of another attack in eastern Congo earlier last week that killed at least 16 people. In Sudan, the last hospital in El Fasher, North Darfur, has shut down after the paramilitary RSF, Rapid Support Forces, raided and looted it Saturday, opening fire inside the hospital. It's not clear if anyone was killed or wounded in the attack. This comes as the World Food Program warns Sudan is on track to become the world's largest humanitarian crisis as aid groups struggle to get food to those in need. On Friday, over 40 people were reported killed in RSF attacks on Omdurman, known as the twin city to the capital, Khartoum. This came just 2 days after RSF fighters killed over 100 people, including dozens of children, in a village in Al Jazeera State. The UN is warning the ongoing fighting in Sudan is creating a massive displacement crisis in the region.
Some 12 million have been forced to flee their homes in Sudan, with over 2 million crossing borders into neighboring countries, mainly Chad, South Sudan, and Egypt, often arriving in extremely vulnerable conditions and highly traumatized.
In Uganda, the environmental activist Stephen Kwikuriza is receiving hospital care after being released from a nearly week-long detention Sunday, where he was reportedly beaten by members of the army. He's believed to have been targeted due to his protests against the French oil company Total Energies, which is involved in the East African crude oil pipeline project known as ECOP. Local activists have been trying to stop development of the 900-mile pipeline, which is set to transport oil from Uganda to Tanzania's Indian Ocean port of Tanga. Narendra Modi has been sworn in as India's prime minister for a third term. Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP lost its parliamentary majority in the recent election, forcing it to form a new coalition government. Modi becomes the first Indian leader since Jawaharlal Nehru to win three straight terms as prime minister. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has finally acknowledged taking more free vacations paid for by billionaire conservative megadonor Harlan Crowe. In a filing Friday, Thomas disclosed he accepted a pair of trips in 2019, one to Indonesia and another to the Bohemian Grove in California. Last year, ProPublica revealed Thomas had failed to disclose at least 38 luxury trips gifted by Crowe and three other right-wing billionaires dating back decades. Environmental groups are criticizing the Biden administration for weakening a plan to make gas-powered SUVs and pickup trucks more fuel efficient. Last year, the National Highway Transportation Safety proposed hiking the average fuel economy standards for the vehicles to 58 miles per gallon by 2032. But under rules issued Friday, the figure has been cut to 50 miles per gallon, just a small increase from the current standard. Dan Becker of the Center for Biological Diversity said the new rule will leave automakers free to, quote, make cars, SUVs, and pickups that will guzzle and pollute for decades and keep America stuck on oil, he said. And a parole hearing is being held today for the imprisoned Native American activist Leonard Peltier, who's been jailed since 1977. Amnesty International's urged the U.S. Parole Commission to grant the 79-year-old parole on humanitarian grounds. Peltier, who is a member of the American Indian Movement, was convicted of involvement in the killing of two FBI agents at the Pine Ridge Reservation, but he has long maintained his innocence. Supporters of Leonard Peltier fear today's hearing could be his last chance to support his freedom. This is his first full parole hearing in 15 years. To hear our interviews with Leonard Peltier, as well as those about his case over the years, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's continuing to bombard Gaza with airstrikes and artillery today, with attacks on Gaza City in the north, Deir al-Bala in the center, and Rafah in the south. At least 40 Palestinians have been killed, over 200 injured in the last 24 hours. The latest attacks follow one of the single bloodiest Israeli assaults on Gaza over the last 8 months. On Saturday, Israeli forces conducted a daytime raid on the Nusayrat refugee camp, that freed four Israelis held hostage in Gaza since October 7th. The hostages were being held in two apartments in the camp. Israel called in heavy strikes from the land, air and sea to cover their evacuation to the coast. At least 274 Palestinians were killed in the attack, including at least 64 children. Nearly 700 were wounded, according to the health ministry in Gaza. The Biden administration reportedly provided intelligence to Israel to aid the hostage rescue effort. The intel included drone imagery collected over Gaza. Hamas later released a video claiming three other hostages, including an American citizen, were killed in the Israeli bombardment. Meanwhile, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has called for an emergency UN Security Council session on what he called the bloody massacre carried out by Israeli forces, unquote, Anuserat. We go now to Gaza to speak with the journalist Akram Al-Sattari. He was at the Nusayrat refugee camp Saturday. He's joining us from outside the Al-Aqsa Hospital nearby in Deir al-Balah, one of the last functioning hospitals in Gaza, which was overwhelmed with casualties on Saturday. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Akram. If you can reconstruct for us what took place in this Israeli effort, not clear if it was aided by the United States, to free Israeli hostages. They were successful in freeing four. What is being described by the United Nations, among others, as a massacre of over 270 Palestinians.
Good morning, Amy. I will start by describing the things in the world of the people who are living moment by moment, second by second, the destruction and the death and the devastation and the continuous fire that has been caused by the Israeli forces in that particular area. To start with, people saw a special, like was described by the people, a special truck that was carrying luggage for internally displaced people, and it proved to be special forces disguising themselves as internally displaced people. They had a ladder, and they set up the ladder on the wall, and they were climbing into the building. But before climbing into the building, there were unmanned drones that were technically gunning down every single person who was in the area. They were shooting at everyone, and then there were some F-16s that were targeting sensitive areas. It was 11 a.m., a very special time with people going to the market, and also was targeting a very special time, a very special place, which is the market, with hundreds and thousands of the people in the market trying to get food for their families, trying to find whatever they can to feed themselves and their families, and then the whole thing started concurrently. The unmanned drones were shooting, the artillery fires were targeted at the buildings, and the also F-16s were dropping bombs on all the different junctions and intersections of the street, and people who were in the market were flying, were trying to flee, were escaping, hiding in the small shops, hiding under the rubble of the areas that were targeted, and that continued for around 30 to 45 minutes, and the result of that was the killing of around 274, and also the injury of nearly 700, like you have just rightly said. There are some people who are still under the rubble because the civil defense in Gaza has been struggling because of the lack of fuel and because of the lack of heavy machinery that would help them remove the debris of the homes, and that's why they are still struggling till now. When I was in the street, even 2 hours after the incident took place, I saw people who are struggling to remove whatever they can remove from under the rubble of their houses. Children were shot and dead. Elderly people were shot and dead. Women were shot and dead. And young people also were shot and dead. In summary, everyone who happened to be in that area or in the area of the Nusayrat market or in the two neighborhoods that were targeted, every single person who was there was killed. Every single house that was there was targeted. And according to local sources, around 98 houses were targeted. And that's why the large number of people who are injured and killed. So it was not a military confrontation between like para militia or just armed groups and the Israeli army. It was rather further intensified targeting of all the civilian infrastructure in the areas, and Israeli army was paving the way for the special forces so that they would end their and complete their operation successfully. And the success as defined by them is the release of the four hostages, while they think the 400 Palestinians or the 1,100 Palestinians who were killed and injured, they perceive them as a collateral damage. And now in An-Nusayrat, this issue is still continuous. There was some bombardment today, and there was some bombardment yesterday, and the bombardment is continuous throughout the Gaza Strip. But the number of the people who are killed and the type of the people who are killed, including the number of children and women, like you rightly said, is quite devastating and shocking.
And Akram, you're standing outside of the Al-Aqsa Hospital, one of the last remaining functioning, at least partially functioning, hospitals in Gaza. With this number of people killed, over 270, and more, the number of people injured, up to 700, can you talk about what is happening inside, as Doctors Without Borders says Al-Aqsa and Nasser hospitals are overwhelmed?
Indeed, they were overwhelmed, and they are still being overwhelmed. They are receiving injured and killed people every single minute in Gaza. Now, as I'm talking to, if you may say in the background, if you may see in the background, people who came there to pick their dear, to pick their family members, to pick their sons, to pick their husbands, to pick their grandchildren, and they're waiting there outside. And not far away from this area, you would see the morgue. In the morgue, tens and even hundreds of bodies are laid on the ground, and people come, and right in this spot that you are seeing now, they're performing the what they call the burial for the prayers for the preparation for the burial. So they take their deeds and they go to the hospital. And every single minute there is a new victim, be it a child, an elderly man or a woman, or a woman or a young or woman or man. And people are just mourning them and coming to that area and living with that continuous destruction and fear. And when it comes to the Shuhada Al-Aqsa Hospital, Shuhada Al-Aqsa Hospital received around half of the victims, half of the ones who were killed. Al-Awda Hospital in An-Nusayrat also received 166 people who were killed and more than 250 of people who were injured, and it was already overwhelmed. Shuhada Al-Aqsa Hospital has a bed capacity of around 240, and now they had to deal with hundreds of people all together coming there, seeking help, crying for help, with daddies wanting to be sure about their overall health, with some other people who are claiming the bodies of their relatives. The hospital is overburdened. It has already the capacity of 240 beds, while they have inside around 650 cases. When you walk inside Shuhada Al-Aqsa Hospital, you would see people sleeping on the ground. You see people who are injured with, like, fixation on their legs, with cast on their legs, with the saline into their veins. But they are staying on the ground, sleeping on the ground, receiving the medication on the ground, and still struggling on the ground because they are not properly dealt with, and the health systems are overburdened by that ongoing and increasing influx and flow of people to that hospital. Nasser Hospital is struggling, Shuhada Al-Aqsa Hospital is struggling, Al-Awda Hospital is struggling, and also other primary health clinics that were set up around different areas, including also some hospitals that were built by different international organizations, are receiving an increased number of victims, and that thing is overburdening every actor in the area, and that makes the mission of the medical teams almost impossible. And that increases the number of victims who are falling because either the direct targeting or because of the repercussion of not receiving the proper and timely health care.
I wanted to ask you about Hamas's reports that while four Israeli hostages were freed, three were killed in the Israeli attack, including an American. What have you heard about this in Nusayrat?
Yeah.
Well, Hamas made a special statement after the operation that was conducted in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. Normally, when they make a statement, they support that statement with footage to make sure that they back their claim. They back their claim with the footage, and they said in that statement that at least three other hostages were injured and were killed. And they provided the footage that supports that claim, and they said that one American citizen was killed amongst those people who were killed. I think that was an attempt from Hamas to show that Israel is resorting to force and Israel is not worried about the life or about the quality of life of those prisoners, and Israel is not worried about the general Palestinian population when they are falling dead or injured by that. This is part of a fight between Israel and Hamas. This is part of an intelligence warfare and psychological warfare between the two parties, and the response of the people in Gaza that Israel did this to them without taking into consideration that there were children and mothers and fathers and grandfathers and general population in that area. And they think Israel is going to continue that. And Hamas, from their side, said that what exactly happened in Al-Nusayrat is going to affect the lives of the Palestinians, of the Israeli captives, and is going to change also the way they are being dealt with, which means they have been saying that they will change the some lenient measures they have been following. Like, for instance, one of the Israeli captives, who's a female, said she was walking down the streets of Gaza. When she's bored, they would take her. She would go, she would visit some places and come back. And I think now, with this operation taking place, with the very heavy price paid by the Palestinians, Hamas and Al-Qassam are going to change the way they are dealing with the prisoners, and that would bring more difficulty to their lives.
I wanted to also ask you about the situation on the ground overall in Gaza, Akram. The U.S. is saying humanitarian aid has resumed in Gaza. Can you talk about the dire needs on the ground? The UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinians, cites a UNICEF report that 9 out of 10 children in the Gaza Strip are experiencing severe food shortages, are experiencing hunger, 9 out of 10 children.
Yes, and I think the very same percentage applies to the adults in the Gaza Strip. The situation is extremely dire. And I would bring to your attention the fact that the World Food Program has just announced today, a couple of hours ago, that they have suspended all their operations in Gaza City because of the insecurity and because of the very deteriorating security situation that has been taking place. They announced also that two of their warehouses were targeted just today, and one of their staff was injured, which gives you an insight into the extremely difficult situation and challenging situation for the international organizations and for the local organizations as well. When you are actively engaging with the community, trying to provide them with food, trying to provide them with water supplies, trying to provide them with medical care, and then you are being targeted, your staff are being injured, and you find it extremely difficult to move from one area to another. So today, the World Food Program announced the stoppage of its activities and said that because of the food security situation, because of the security situation in Gaza, that is likely to increase food insecurity. So the situation is extremely catastrophic, and the ground operations and the bombardment and the lack of security and safety for the staff, either local ones or the international ones, adds insult to injury and makes things much more difficult for the people of Gaza. 1 million children in Gaza are suffering because there are 1 million children in Gaza. The elderly people are also suffering. All the general population in Gaza is suffering, and even when it comes to access to water, they have a problem accessing the water because the water desalination units were affected by the ongoing bombardment, and now people are suffering from hepatitis A. And as we are talking now, there are some people, more people are coming, injured people are coming to the hospital. This is part of the daily routine in the Gaza Strip. More people coming, more people injured, more people deprived, more people suffering, more people losing, more people in despair, more people hope that something positive would happen to change the routine that has become in the Gaza, that has become in the Gaza Strip. As you can see, a woman is taken inside, another woman is following, and other family members are following them. So now it is not about the food. It's more about the survival. And now the food is being weaponized for the sake of just torturing the Gazans more, for the sake of inflicting more pain on them, and for the sake of just making them bow their heads. Now Gazans are totally and entirely displaced. Around 95% of the population is already displaced. And in the areas they are displaced, they don't have access to proper services, to proper infrastructure, to proper food, and to proper water. And they are left to suffer, and they left to face the death and fear with no one extending a helping hand, except for the nominal support that has been extended. 88 trucks in one day is nothing for Gaza that needs around 1,000 truckloads a day. And now Gaza is suffering. And as I told you, I repeat and underline the very important fact. The critical issue for Gazans is survival now. Food is being weaponized. We understand that all. But also another weapon is being used. In one of the internally displaced people shelters today morning, in between Rafah and Khan Yunis, the unmanned drones were technically shooting at everyone. I saw several children dead. I saw several women injured. I saw other women who was injured and killed. So the security situation, because of the ongoing operations and because of its strict blockade that has been imposed in Gaza, is undermining people's ability to cope and is wasting their life and wasting their energies as well.
Akram al-Sattari, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Talking to us from Deir al-Balah was just in Nusayrat after the Israeli military freed four hostages and killed what's believed to be over 270 Palestinians, scores of them children. When we come back, we'll continue to look at this with a Palestinian-American analyst in Washington, D.C., then two Israelis, one of them lost both parents in the Hamas attack of October 7th. Stay with us.
Imagine waking up to metal birds blocking the sunlight. Everybody trapped now, black clouds made it become night. In the Holy Land, how you got us living the slum life? My God, look at what it's become like. Mothers in Palestine gotta carry their sons twice. Trusted y'all at the sleepover. The overseers build walls we can't see over. Freedom is a luxury afforded by freeloaders to put us in shallow graves and sheep in a deep coma. But thieves cannot be owners.
Metal Birds by Belly. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For more on the Israeli attack on the Nusayrat refugee camp that freed four Israeli hostages and killed at least 274 Palestinians, wounding over about 700 people, we're joined by Omar Badar, a Palestinian-American political analyst, member of the National Policy Council of the Arab American Institute. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. If you can overall respond to what took place, and then, because you're in D.C., Omar, talk about the Biden administration response.
Sure. Amy, there's no question that what unfolded in that operation is a massacre. I mean, we've seen just the bodies of hundreds of people littered everywhere, including the bodies of children. We've seen absolutely horrific scenes at the hospitals of weeping parents and bloody children. I mean, to look at a death toll of this scale and then to celebrate this kind of operation as some sort of success, you would basically have to openly say that the lives of Israelis are more valuable than the lives of Palestinians. That is the message that is sent by celebrating this operation. Now, there is no surprise at the fact that an apartheid government like Israel's would see it that way. They've made very clear that they have absolutely no regard for Palestinian life, that they don't see Palestinians as equal human beings deserving of the same dignity and rights that Israelis enjoy. But what's really disappointing is looking at the way that the Biden administration has reacted to all this, where the massacre is reduced to a footnote while the focus is primarily on the lives of the hostages who have been rescued. That kind of contrast, this declaration from the Biden administration that the lives of Palestinians matter less than the lives of Israelis, is just absolutely outrageous and completely indefensible. It speaks to a fundamentally broken dynamic with American foreign policy towards the region for a very, very long time, in which Israel is treated like a country that is above the law and above any rules, and their lives simply matter more and they can do whatever they want so long as it favors Israel at the expense of the people around them. And that kind of approach has actually guaranteed that we're going to be living in a situation of perpetual conflict, because anytime you treat Palestinians the way Israel treats them, put them under indefinite military occupation, rob them of their rights, of their land, treat them the way Palestinians are treated day in and day out under this brutal occupation, you are creating fertile ground for conflict, and that's why we're in the situation that we're in the first place.
Omar, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, said on the Sunday talk shows, quote, innocent people were tragically killed in this operation. The exact number we don't know, but innocent people were killed, and that's heartbreaking. That's tragic.
Yeah. Amy, just imagine if it was the other way around, right? Imagine right now, as you and I are speaking, there are thousands of Palestinians who have been kidnapped out of Gaza. They're placed in Israeli detention centers across the border. And the treatment that they are witnessing day in and day out has been absolutely horrifying. There's a report in the New York Times from just a few days ago outlining the daily sexual abuse that these prisoners are actually undergoing, the torture. And we know for a fact that dozens of Palestinians have been killed in Israeli captivity over the past several months since October 7th to this day. And if you were to imagine a scenario right now in which Hamas conducts an operation, kills several hundred Israelis, and then rescues four Palestinians from Israeli detention, would anybody even know the names of those four Palestinians who have been rescued? Or would the entire world and our discourse be condemning the massacre that had taken place? Would that be what's dominating the headlines? We know the answer to that, and we know that we would not be reducing the massacre to nothing had it been the other way around. So yes, maybe Jake Sullivan can talk about how tragic it is that people are dying, but when push comes to shove, the United States is providing the military funding that is allowing for these casualties to occur on a regular basis. At this point, every major human rights organization in the world is describing Israeli conduct in Gaza as war crimes. They are describing the deliberate starving of children. Several of them have died of starvation as well. We are witnessing that the International Court of Justice has found that Israel is plausibly committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. And in light of all this, for the Biden administration to continue providing unlimited and unconditional military funding for Israel to carry on this genocidal slaughter in Gaza while expressing regret at the fact that some civilians are dying in the process, I mean, just who are they fooling? They are responsible for it in a direct way. If they do find it tragic, there is a very, very easy solution to it, and that is to put an end to U.S. military funding for Israel until Israel starts abiding by international law and stops this indiscriminate onslaught on the civilian population in Gaza.
I want to go to President Biden during a joint press conference with the French President Macron on Saturday.
But before I begin my remarks, I want to echo President Macron's comments welcoming the safe rescue of four hostages that were returned to their families in Israel. We won't stop working until all the hostages come home and a ceasefire is reached. That is essential to happen.
So what about this ceasefire? What about this deal? What about Israel and Hamas? The U.S. focuses on Hamas, whether they will accept the deal. President Biden introduced it as an Israeli deal, and yet Netanyahu has not approved this deal.
Amy, I think it's really important for your audience to actually understand a bit of the merits of that ceasefire proposal. There has long been tension between the Israeli position, which is effectively a temporary ceasefire, a return of all the hostages to Israel, and then a continuation of the war, of this onslaught on Gaza that has so far killed nearly 40,000 people and just destroyed the overwhelming majority of the Gaza Strip. And the Hamas position, on the other hand, they're saying they're willing to give up the hostages, but they need an end to this onslaught. They want a permanent ceasefire. And the proposal that Biden put forward effectively presents two phases. Phase one is a temporary ceasefire, and phase two is the permanent one. And in between, he's left it vague about what needs to be negotiated in order to get to the permanent ceasefire bit. And Netanyahu, I mean, both sides are suspicious for different reasons, right? Hamas is suspicious of that kind of deal because they're afraid they're going to be forced to give up nearly all the hostages at phase one, and then the war is simply going to continue. And from Netanyahu's perspective, he's worried that when the war is halted in that temporary ceasefire, that the U.S. is going to apply significant pressure on Netanyahu to turn it into a permanent ceasefire. Now, Netanyahu immediately came out and effectively rejected any idea that the Biden plan is going to end the war, because he said all Israel has offered is a plan that allows us to continue this war until Hamas is completely destroyed. So he's effectively openly rejected that deal. And the Biden administration, as it always does, then turns around and applies all the pressure that they want to on the Palestinian side. Now they're trying to pressure Qatar into potentially throwing out Hamas, the Hamas leadership out of Qatar if they don't accept that deal. So time and again, we see this pattern where when push comes to shove, the Biden administration is unwilling to apply any meaningful pressure on Israel. They threatened it here and there. They talk about potentially withholding some weapons. And the second there's any bit of criticism of the Biden administration from right-wing politicians and, frankly, some establishment mainstream ones about how Biden is not backing Israel sufficiently, Biden immediately panics and just throws another unlimited supply of weapons in Israel and says that Israel can do whatever it wants. That dynamic is not going to lead to anything positive. We can't get an end to this onslaught if Biden is afraid to apply meaningful pressure on Netanyahu or on Israel. That has long been the core of the issue. By the way, not just in reference to this particular ceasefire effort, but it really is about the broader dynamic of Israel and the United States, where the impunity that Israel enjoys to continue this occupation, to entrench the occupation in the West Bank and in Gaza, and the fact that Biden has always offered unconditional diplomatic support and unconditional military support, that allows extremism to fester within the Israeli government. And that's what pushes their policies in a more and more extreme direction, where there is no possibility right now for a genuine, long-lasting, just peace, because the Israeli government rejects that completely out of hand. And the only thing that can change that is a shift in American approach and to start saying that America will not be complicit in these kinds of atrocities, will not be complicit in entrenching apartheid and occupation, because that is not a recipe for a stable region or for any kind of long-lasting peace or justice.
Omar Badar, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Palestinian-American political analyst, member of the National Policy Council of the Arab American Institute. When we come back, we'll be joined by two Israelis. One near Tel Aviv lost his parents on October 7th. He says Israel's war is not the answer. The other here in New York is the head of idealist.org. Back in 20 seconds.
Well, I think it's fine building jumbo planes, taking a ride on a cosmic train. Switch on summer from a slot machine. Just get what you want if you want, as you can get anything. I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day. Tell me, where do the children play?
Where do the children play? By Yusuf Islam, used to be formerly known as Cat Stevens. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israelis celebrated the return of the four Israeli hostages in Saturday's raid. The four hostages, Noah Agamani, Almag Meirjan, Andrei Kozlov, and Shlomo Ziv, were all in good medical condition. Just hours after the rescue, thousands of Israelis gathered in Tel Aviv and throughout Israel to protest Prime Minister Netanyahu's government, calling for a deal to free the remaining hostages. Some 120 hostages remain in Gaza, with 43 known dead. 105 hostages were released in a week-long ceasefire deal in November. Only three other hostages have been freed by military force since the start of the war. Another three were mistakenly killed by Israeli forces after they escaped on their own. Hamas says others have been killed in Israeli airstrikes. Meanwhile, the Biden administration's pushing for a deal announced by President Biden over a week ago that sets forth a phased plan for a ceasefire and the release of hostages. Biden described the plan as an Israeli proposal, but Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has publicly questioned it, particularly its call for the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza and a lasting truce. Hamas has demanded international guarantees that the war will end. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Benyamina, near Tel Aviv, we're joined by Mao Zinon. He lost both of his parents, Bilha and Yaakov Inon, in the Hamas attack on October 7th. He has called for the Israeli assault on Gaza to end. Inon wrote an article for Al Jazeera titled, "Hamas Killed My Parents, But Israel's War Is Not the Answer." And joining us here in New York, Amidar, an Israeli social entrepreneur. He's the executive director of Idealist.org. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Maoz, let's begin with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Can you first respond to what took place this weekend in Nusayrat, the freeing of the four hostages and the killing of over 270 Palestinians by Israeli forces?
Yeah. Amy, thank you for inviting me to speak with you and in your show. I've been listening from the beginning of the show about the equation of death. It's the equation of the devil. Four Israeli hostages equal to 270 casualties, Palestinian casualties. We are all human. No human, no Israelis, no Palestinian, not my parents, no one on planet Earth deserve to be part of this equation. No one. And we must implement a new equation, the equation of life. And this is what I'm saying since losing my parents, that the only way to bring the hostages back is by a deal. All hostages in exchange for all Palestinian prisoners. 8 months has passed. And we lost so many lives, so many lives of the hostages, so many Palestinian lives. And there is no meaning. There is no meaning and no excuse, a justification for the suffering, for the pain, for the agony we are facing and living through. And what I'm afraid and what I'm crying for is that it might be only the beginning. It might be only the beginning, and we might face the numbers. We already forgot from Rwanda. 1 million people were genocide, were killed in a period of 3 months in Rwanda. And it took the world 3 months to wake up and to act. And I cannot understand what will make the world to act. Only a number of million victims between the river and the sea. I already lost my parents. And I don't want no human being to be in the position I am. And we must stop it, and we must start a new phase in humanity, that we are not solving conflicts through war, through bloodshed, through revenge, but we resolve conflicts through dialogue, through envisioning a better future, deciding and agreeing on the values of the future, our common ground as humans. We all deserve better. We all deserve better, and we must make the future better than what we've been going through now.
So, Maoz, can you tell us about what's happening across the country, across Israel? You have these mass protests over the weekend before and after the hostages were released. Thousands of Israelis calling for Netanyahu to agree to a ceasefire. They're hit by water cannons. There were over 30 arrested. Can you talk about what this movement is about? And also, Benny Gantz quitting the war cabinet. What meaning does this have?
Okay. I'm not a political analyst. I'm a peace activist. I lost my parents. And I believe that peace is possible. I know that peace is possible. And this is what me and my partners, Palestinian Israeli partners, are working on now, day and night, to bring peace to this land. But I would start by differentiating between the Israeli government and the Israeli people. The Israeli government has been working now for decades into achieving one goal, is a Jewish / Israeli supremacy between the river and the sea, through settlements, through occupation, through oppressioning the Palestinian people within Israel, and in the West Bank in Gaza. And while this is what the government wants to do and acting on to execute it, the Israeli people want security and safety. The Israeli people are traumatized. I traumatized from October 7th, and I can take it back in history. The Israeli people are still traumatized from the Holocaust. It's an ongoing trauma that we are facing again and again. And we must cure the Israeli people. And at the same time, of course, we must cure and take in accountability the Palestinian people, because there will be no security and safety to one without the other. So how can we cure? How can we cure our people? And this is what on stake. And while the protests or guns, again, they are calling for a deal. This is the people on the street are calling for a deal, because more and more Israelis do understand that the safest and most humanitarian way to release the hostages without risking no one's, Israelis and Palestinians alike, is through a deal. But it's in the against the interest of the government, because if like your reporter's analysis said before, because if the hostages will be back home, then the government will need to deal with the day after. And they don't care about the day after. They want the day after to look like the present. They want the bloodshed, the revenge, the war and the fear to continue, because it serves them in their greater mission, the greater mission of Jewish-Israeli supremacy between the river and the sea. And this is why the world must act. The world cannot wait. It's time not for talks or for speeches. It's time for action, to stop the war immediately, to make a deal, all hostages in exchange for all Palestinian prisoners, and start working to build a better future. We must envision a peaceful future between the river and the sea, and building a roadmap to make it happen. So, because our leaders are not doing it, because of lack of leadership, and Gantz is just an example of a politician that has no political imagination. He believes only in force, in military respond to whatever circumstance or situation is. But this is not what we need here. We need a political imagination to envision a better future, a diplomatic solution, like Israel knew how to do in the past with Jordan and with Egypt. And those are the only borders where we have security and safety.
We've been speaking with Maoz Inon, who lost both of his parents, Bilha and Yaakovi, on October 7th, wrote the article, "Hamas killed my parents, but Israel's war is not the answer." In New York, we're joined by Ami Dar, executive director of Idealist.org, also an Israeli. I'm wondering if you, too, can respond to what happened this weekend, how it's been portrayed in the United States. And Ben-Gavir, who's now that Benny Gantz has quit the war cabinet, saying he wants to be put into the war cabinet, saying that this freeing of the four hostages, Hamas says three others, including an American, were killed. But Ben-Gavir says this shows that the rescue operation means that military pressure, not a deal, is how to free hostages. Ami.
Well, good morning, Ami. Thanks for having me. First, I just want to say that I'm in awe of Maoz Inon. I think he's been one of my moral hero since this started. I think having your parents murdered and then working for peace, I'm in awe of him and of people like him in Gaza who are in the same situation, who have lost their families, and they keep talking about peace. I think they're the true heroes here. I think that, like everyone who spoke here so far, it was in the morning when I heard that the four hostages had been rescued a few minutes after it happened. So obviously there's a feeling of relief for the families of those people and for the four people themselves. This is not, you know, their fault. They should have never been taken. And so it was wonderful that they went back. As the day progressed and the news came out of you know, the scope of the operation and the number of people who had been died and wounded, I was progressively horrified the whole day. But then this is part, I think, as Maoz was saying, this is part of the last 8 months. I mean, I think that you know, on October 10th, I went on Twitter and I said, you know, revenge is not a strategy. And I grieve for their kids as much as I grieve for ours. And our tears, you know, taste the same and our blood is the same color. I mean, that has to be the approach, which is why people like Maoz and people like me have been calling for what's been called in Israel an all-for-all exchange from the very, very beginning. The very first week, Israel should have acknowledged, look, we lost this round, basically. And now we have to pay the price. And the price is life comes first. Life always comes first. Let's get all the hostages back. And if that means that every single detainee and prisoner, Palestinians in Israeli prisons, is released, then so be it. Life comes first. That's been my position from the very beginning, and it's still my position now. And, you know, when you say these things, you get attacked from sort of every side. It doesn't change it. And I think what pains me the most is that this will end with a deal. We all know this. We've all been around. This will end with a deal. And I keep thinking, Emmy, you and I are both old enough. I remember, you know, John Kerry testifying in Congress in the early 70s and saying, you know, how do you tell the last man to die that he died for a mistake? And who will be the last Israeli, last Palestinian to die hours before this deal gets made? Because there will be a deal. So do the deal. Just get it done. Both Sinwar in Gaza and Netanyahu in Israel, just do the damn deal. Sorry, I'm not a professional. I'm just here. Sorry for using that word. I'm also not representing idealists. I'm just representing myself. But just do the deal. Get it done. Get everyone home, Palestinians and Israelis.
And what do you think of Netanyahu being invited by the U.S. Congress, by the House Speaker, but also the man who criticized him, Chuck Schumer? It might have surprised many that he did criticize Netanyahu, but he did. But now you have Hakeem Jeffries, Schumer, House Speaker Johnson, all inviting him to give an address to a joint session of Congress.
Yeah, I think I understand why they're doing it, in the sense that I think they're doing it as, you know, I have a four-year-old at home, and I know that if I give her a piece of chocolate, she may do something that I want her to do. I think they're trying to offer him a very big piece of chocolate to try to get him to do what they want him to do. I think, let me start from the end, it would be absolutely disgraceful for him to address Congress without a deal having been done already. I mean, that would be honestly insane. Without him saying that he is for a deal, without actually him saying that he's for the whole deal that Biden is proposing, which is this whole two-state solution, you know, the whole thing. Having him there without that, I think, is going to be a disgrace. And I also suspect it's going to be a disaster for him. I don't think that the whole of Congress will just take this quietly. I think this is not going to end well if it's done without actually something to celebrate.
And Maoz, the significance of President Biden, and I'll ask you this question, Ami, as well, promising Israel now something like $1 billion of military weapons as this assault continues and intensifies in Gaza?
And support Israel can receive. Israel need to receive an aid to be cured from our trauma, reconciliation aid, shared future and peace aid. We don't need more military weapon. We don't need to have our bunkers supplied with bombs. And I want to again, Ami, it's a pleasure and honor to be with you in the same panel. And what I realized, and I believe now, is that the only war which is won is war which leads to peace. And Israel, I'm afraid to say, lost all its wars under the prime minister of Benjamin Netanyahu. He's the worst leader Israel ever had, and probably the worst leader the Jewish people ever had. And we must stop his position, and we must start a new leadership. And if we'll need the assistance and the aid of the American people, of both Congress and Senate, from the Republicans and the Democratic Party to support us to win to win a war after 30 years of defeats. And to win a war means to make peace. This is the only way for the future. This is what we deserve. And we are not going to compromise again on a ceasefire. We are not going to compromise for anything less than a lasting peace.
And Ami, if you can, in this last 30 seconds we have, you're here in the United States, you're an Israeli, address both audiences.
I think that the single in 30 seconds, I think anyone who's outside of the whole region who wants to actually see peace win, I don't think it's possible for Israel to win. I don't think Palestinians can win. I think only peace can win. Any side winning, in quotes, means the whole region loses. Only peace can win. And so do whatever you can to support those people on both sides across the region who are doing what they can to get people together. Anything bringing people together is good. Anything pulling people apart is bad. Support those who are trying to make people come together. And maybe we come out of this. Maybe. I'm not optimistic.
Ami Dar, executive director of Idealist.org, and Mao Zedong lost both his parents in the October 7th attack, calling for peace. Also, many of his friends. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
RCT in sound from way out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk more about the attacks on pro-Palestinian protesters with the president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council.
Co-founder and president Salam al-Mariati joins us to talk about his efforts to hold university officials and law enforcement accountable for allowing attacks against pro-Palestinian protesters.
We'll also speak with graduate student Javier Fitzsimmons-Cruz, who was arrested after the encampment was torn down.
He vividly describes the situation at the NYU encampment, and after all, he ran from his arrest to defend his dissertation.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
As the Israeli-Gaza war rages on, protests have spread throughout American campuses as students oppose Israeli military onslaught and the tragic humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Students have demanded a ceasefire, an end to U.S. military support for Israel, and that universities divest from Israel. In response, university officials have suspended and expelled students, banned pro-Palestinian student groups, called in the police, and sent mixed messages on students' right to free speech. At UCLA, a group of counter-protesters launched a violent attack on pro-Palestinian protesters. To address these critical issues, we've invited Salam al-Mariati, president and co-founder of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where he oversees MPAC's groundbreaking civic engagement, public policy, and advocacy work. Salam al-Mariati is an expert on Islam in the West, Muslim reform movements, human rights, democracy, national security, and Middle East politics. He's spoken at the White House and on Capitol Hill and has represented the U.S. at international human rights and religious freedom conferences. He's very active in interfaith dialogue, which is where I first met him in the wake of 9/11 in my capacity as a leader of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. Salam, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be with you, Stephen. Always good to hear from you.
What's happened at UCLA has gained national attention. On May 3rd, your organization, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, sent a letter to the Department of Education and its Office for Civil Rights calling for an investigation into the violent April 30 attacks on pro-Palestinian student protesters at UCLA by pro-Zionist agitators. In response, the Office of Civil Rights promptly initiated an official investigation into the incident under Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Salam, please describe those attacks for our listeners and tell us what's the current status of the investigation.
Sure. I'd also like to first describe the context of the encampments themselves. I attended four of them, Vanderbilt, George Washington, UCLA, and USC. All of them were peaceful. In fact, a recent study from a center at Princeton said that of the 3,700 encampments established throughout the country on universities' property, 95% had been